Hello, and welcome to another installment of The First 10 Pages. Thank you for joining me. I'm your host, Keith, and I am a writer who is going to look at, this time, the screenplay of Aliens by James Cameron and other people, and we'll get to that. And as you know, it is a sequel to Alien. That's why there's an S at the end. Studios will say the first 10 pages are what you need to capture their attention. If you don't capture their attention in 10 pages, you're kaput. Your script is kaput. They don't want to hear from you. Now, I mean, if we're being honest, yeah, and I've said this before, and I'll say it again, it's probably going to be less than 10 pages for most people. But if you're James Cameron, they're definitely going to give you at least 10 pages to capture their attention. So, yeah, that's what we're talking about. As always, this will start with me talking a little bit about the movie and then doing a script read. I promise the script read will be fun, but you will be able to skip it and I will give you a timestamp for that. And you can go right to the conversation at the end. The conversation is really more of a monologue because I'm the only one here. Anywho, that's how this works. If you are a fan of the Alien franchise, and who isn't, you probably know that there is a lot of drama around this movie. Before this movie was made, then after it was made, and during the making. We're not gonna get into all that. It ain't gonna happen. This is a podcast that focuses on writing, so that's what we're gonna be talking about. The writing, the screenplay. What was on screen, what was on paper, why it changed, what works, what doesn't, why certain decisions may have been made. Now, I don't have any behind-the-scenes details on all the changes that were made to the script, but you will notice that there are some major changes from the script that I have to what was on the screen. But for now, let's get to the details about Aliens. Released in July 1986. That was the same year of a whole lot of big movies. Crocodile Dundee, Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, Top Gun, The Karate Kid Part 2, The Fly, Howard the Duck, famously a huge flop, and a bunch of other big movies and little movies. Oh, Platoon came out that year. My goodness, what a year of film. And Howard the Duck. According to Wikipedia, its opening weekend, it beat out The Karate Kid Part 2 and Ruthless People, which is a movie that nobody talks about anymore. People need to see Ruthless People. I don't know where it's at, where you could find it. That's a good movie. Danny DeVito, Bette Midler, Judge Reinhold, Bill Pullman, other people. Go find it. Go find it right now. Pause this. Pause. Okay, yeah. And then stream it, or rent it, or download it, or pirate it if you have to. I bet it's on YouTube. I bet someone like put it on YouTube because it's nowhere else. It's not on any of the streamers that I could find, at least last I checked. And I bet someone put it on YouTube, and it has no commercials if you have an ad blocker on your browser, and you can go watch it. Go watch it. Go. I'll be here. I swear. Okay, so now that you've seen Ruthless People, let's get back to Aliens.
Aliens?
Total gross in the US was about $85 million. Numbers internationally for that time were a little harder to come by, according to the Wikipedia entry. According to Fox's 1992 estimate, Aliens earned $157 million worldwide. The New York Times described the film as extremely successful. In case you're unaware, who made Aliens? The story was by James Cameron, who's also the director, David Giler, and Walter Hill. If you don't know, they're pretty amazing. Film director Walter Hill had written The Getaway, which is a Sam Peckinpah film starring Steve McQueen. The Drowning Pool, a well-known thriller from, I want to say the 70s, right? Yeah, mid-70s. He might be best known for directing and writing The Warriors, a crazy film about a gang trying to get back to its turf and has to go through an obstacle course of other crazy gangs in New York. That's a pretty wild movie if you haven't seen it. Highly recommend it. 48 Hours, wrote and directed that. That's the Eddie Murphy, Nick Nolte movie from 1982. There's a movie that he directed. I have to find it that I loved that nobody else loved. Trespass, 1992. Same year that Alien 3 came out. I love Trespass. Maybe go check it out. Nobody else likes it, but I dig it. And David Giler was the screenwriter of The Parallax View, a very well-known political thriller starring Warren Beatty, also worth a viewing. He wrote Fun with Dick and Jane. That was a great movie. There was a remake of it, but this is the George Segal, Jane Fonda version. With both Hill and Giler, there's a ton of movies after Aliens that I'm not listing here. I'm just listing the things that they did prior to Aliens that kind of led them there. These guys have... both have very prolific careers as writers, producers. They're big deals. And they were big deals in part because of Aliens, but also before Aliens. James Cameron at the time was, of course, best known for The Terminator, but he also wrote the screenplay for Rambo First Blood Part 2. Yeah, that was a big deal in 1983? 85. First Blood, it was less of an action movie and more of a drama thriller. It did very well, so of course... how do you follow up the dramatic film about the tortured Vietnam vet, but by putting a bandana on his head, taking off his shirt, and sending him into the Middle East, if I recall? I think they sent him to Vietnam to get someone, right? I don't know. I don't remember. It doesn't matter. It's a ridiculous, wonderful movie, as was First Blood in its own way. Let's get back to Aliens. If you want to skip the script read, go to this time mark. Don't skip the script read.
Go to 2151.
Oh yeah, and I decided to read it kind of like I'm narrating a documentary on predators. I'm not sure what I'm going to do for the other characters, but it's very possible Paul Reiser's character is going to sound like Jerry Seinfeld.
Aliens by James Cameron. Final, September 23rd, 1985. Fade in. Sometime in the future, space, silent and endless, the stars shine like the love of God, cold and remote. Against them drifts a tiny chip of technology, closer. It is the Narcissus, lifeboat of the ill-fated star freighter Nostromo. Without interior or running lights, it seems devoid of life. The ping of a ranging radar grows louder, closer. A shadow engulfs the Narcissus. Searchlights flash on, playing over the tiny ship as a massive dark hull descends toward it. Interior Narcissus. Dark and dormant as a crypt, the searchlights stream in the dusty windows. Outside, massive metal forms can be seen.
Sometimes I'll be, like, stressing certain words because they're in caps, so I'm trying to make those stand out. But sometimes it's hard to make them stand out because I'm already speaking...
like this.
Anyway.
Descending around the shuttle. Like the tolling of a bell, a basso profundo clang reverberates through the hull. Close on the airlock door. Light glares as a cutting torch bursts through the metal, moving with machine precision, cutting a rectangular path. The torch cuts off. The door falls inward, revealing a bizarre, multi-armed figure, a robot welder. Figures enter, backlit and ominous. Three men in bio-isolation suits, carrying lights and equipment. They approach a sarcophagus-like hypersleep capsule, FG.
Foreground.
The leader's gloved hand wipes at an opaque layer of dust on the canopy. Angle inside capsule. As light stabs in where the dust is wiped away, illuminating a woman, her face in peaceful repose. Warrant Officer Ripley. Sole survivor of the Nostromo. Nestled next to her is Jones, the ship's wayward cat. Leader.
Bio readouts are all in the green. She's alive. Well, there goes our salvage, guys.
Dissolve to... exterior, space, Earth, orbit. Panning across the serene blue curve of Earth as seen from high orbit onto Gateway Station. A sprawling complex of modular orbital habitats. In FG, a viewing portal opens in a vertical wall of the medical station. Interior hospital room. Harsh sunlight fills the room as the notarized... No, not notarized, that is a typo. As the motorized shield continues to rise, a female medtech turns from the window controls.
Watch your eyes.
She crosses to a bed in which Ripley lies, looking wan amid an array of arcane white medical equipment. The tech exudes practiced cheeriness, but Ripley isn't buying it.
When am I going to see someone in authority? So, feeling stronger, are we? We are tired of the runaround. Why won't anyone tell me what's going on? How long has it been?
Well, you've been here at Gateway Station for 3 days. You were pretty groggy at first, so...
Look, I know that part. How long was I in hypersleep?
The tech glances up as the door opens off-screen. She smiles, saved by the distraction.
Looks like you have a visitor.
A man crosses the room carrying a familiar large orange tomcat.
Jones!
Ignoring the man, she grabs the cat and hugs it to her. Jones seems none the worse for wear and begins to purr.
Jonesy, you ugly thing.
The visitor sits beside the bed, and Ripley finally notices him. He is 30-ish and handsome, in a suit that looks executive or legal, the tie loosened with studied casualness, a smile referred to as winning.
Nice room. I'm Burke, Carter Burke. I work for the company. But other than that, I'm an okay guy. Glad to see you're feeling better.
Ripley's gaze turns stony.
You're with the company. Then you're the last person I want to be talking to.
Genuinely wounded.
Why is that?
Because I'm bringing you guys up on charges. Willful negligence leading to the deaths of my crew. For starters.
Whoa, Ripley! That's not me. Those guys are gone. There have been some changes. That's what I came here to tell you about.
How long was I out there?
It's bad, kiddo. It's gonna be a shock.
She grabs his arm, surprisingly strong.
How long? 57 years.
Ripley is stunned. She seems to deflate, her expression passing through amazement and shock to realization of all she has lost. Friends, family, her world.
57. Oh, Christ.
You drifted right through the core systems. It's blind luck that Deep Salvage team caught you when they did. 1 in 1,000. You're just damn lucky to be alive.
While Burke is talking, we have pushed in to a tight close-up on Jones, who begins to hiss and struggle in Ripley's arms. We go into subtle slow motion. The cat leaps to the floor, bounding away. Ripley coughs suddenly, as if choking. Her expressions become one of dawning horror. Burke, unaware of what is coming, hands her a glass of water from the nightstand. She slaps it away. It shatters with a smash. Jones dives, yowling, under a cabinet. Ripley grabs her chest, struggling as if she is strangling. The medtech hits a console button.
Code blue, 415. Code blue, 415.
Burke and the medtech are holding Ripley's shoulders as she goes into convulsions. A doctor and two techs run in. Ripley's back arches in agony.
No. No.
They try to restrain her as she thrashes, knocking over equipment. Her EKG races like mad. Jones, under the cabinet, hisses wide-eyed. Doctor.
Hold her. Get me an airway, stat. And 15 cc's of...
Jesus.
Ripley stares at the shape rising under the sheet, tearing itself out of her. A glimpse of the chittering horror. It screeches. Right on Ripley, screaming, snapping up into frame. Alone in the darkened hospital room. She gasps for breath, clutching pathetically at her chest. There is no demented horror ripping itself out of her. Her eyes snap about wildly, slowing, slowly, typo, focusing on the reality of her safety. Shuddering, bathed in sweat. She kneads her breastbone with the heel of her hand and sobs. A video monitor beside the bed snaps on the medtech's face.
Bad dreams again? Do you want something to help you sleep?
No, I've slept enough.
The tech shrugs and switches off. Touching a button on the nightstand, Ripley opens the viewport, revealing Gateway in the turquoise earth. She hugs Jones to her and rocks with him like a child, still shattered by the nightmare. Cut to...
Exterior park. Sunlight streams in shafts through the stand of poplars, beyond which a verdant meadow is visible. Jones stalks toward a bird, hopping among fallen leaves. He leaps and smacks into a wall. Ripley voiceover.
That's brilliant, Jones.
Visor. Miser? Wider. It's a typo. It says wiser. It should be wider. As Jones steps back, confused from the high-resolution environmental wall screen, a sort of cinerama video loop, Ripley sits on a bench in what we now see is an atrium off the medical center. Burke enters in his usual mode, casual haste.
Sorry, I've been running behind all morning.
Have they located my daughter yet?
Well, I was going to wait until after the inquest.
Is she?
Burke scanning.
Amanda Ripley McLaren. Married name, I guess. Age 66 at time of death. 2 years ago. I'm sorry.
Ripley studies the photograph, stunned. The face of a woman in her mid-60s. It could be anybody. She tries to reconcile the face with the little girl she once knew.
Any cancer? They still haven't licked that one. Cremated, interred Westlake Repository, Little Chute, Wisconsin. No children.
Ripley gazes off into the pseudo-landscape, into the past.
No children.
A beat, then.
I promised her I'd be home for her birthday. Her 11th birthday. Some promises you just can't keep.
Let's get one thing straight. Ripley can be one tough lady. But the terror, the loss, the emptiness are, in this moment, overwhelming. She cries silently. Burke puts a reassuring hand on her arm.
The hearing convenes at 09:30. You don't want to be late.
Interior corridor gateway. Elevator doors part, and Ripley emerges in mid-conversation with Burke.
You read my deposition. It's complete and accurate.
Look, I believe you, but there are going to be some heavyweights in there. You've got feds, you've got Interstellar Commerce Commission, you've got Colonial Administration, insurance company guys.
I get the picture.
Just tell them what happened. The important thing is to stay cool and unemotional.
Interior conference room on Ripley Gateway. Not cool, not unemotional.
Do you people have earwax or what? We have been here 3 hours. How many different ways do you want me to tell the same story?
She faces the 8 members of the Board of Inquiry at a long conference table. Gray suits and grim faces. They aren't buying. Behind Ripley on a large video screen, Parker grins like a goon from his personnel mugshot. His file prints out next to it. Brett's face and dossier replace it. And then the others as the scene continues. Kane. Lambert. Ash the android traitor. Dallas. Van Leeuwen, the ICC representative, steeples his fingers and frowns.
Look at it from our perspective, please. You freely admit to detonating the engines of, and thereby destroying, an M-class star freighter, a rather expensive piece of hardware.
Insurance investigator.
$42 million in adjusted dollars. That's minus payload, of course.
The lifeboat's flight recorder corroborates some elements of your account. That, for reasons unknown, the Nostromo set down on LV-426, an unsurveyed planet at the time. That it resumed its course and was subsequently set for self-destruct by you, for reasons unknown.
Look, I told you,
we set down there on company orders to get this thing which destroyed all of us and your precious ship.
The recorder did not contain any entries concerning this hostile organism you allegedly picked up.
Oh, that's cute. Allegedly. I like that.
Van Leeuwen sighs with exasperation.
The analysis team, which went over the lifeboat centimeter by centimeter, found no physical evidence of the creature you describe.
That's because I blew it out of the goddamn airlock. Like I said.
Are there any species like this hostile organism on LV-426?
No, it's a rock. No indigenous life.
Ripley grits her teeth in frustration.
What? Did IQs drop sharply while I was gone? I already said it was non-indigenous. There was a derelict spacecraft, an alien ship. It wasn't from there. Get it? We homed on its beacon.
And found something which has never been reported once from over 300 surveyed worlds. A creature,
she reads from Ripley's statement,
gestates inside a living host, these are your words, and has concentrated acid for blood.
Look, I can see where this is going. But I'm telling you, those things exist. Kane, the guy that went in, said he saw thousands of eggs in that ship. Thousands!
Thank you, Officer Ripley. That will be...
You're not listening. Just one of those things managed to kill my entire crew.
Van Leeuwen stands out of patience.
Thank you. That will be all.
That's not all, goddammit. If those things get back here, that will be all. Then you can just kiss all this goodbye. Just kiss it goodbye.
Interior corridor. Ripley kicks the wall next to Burke, who is getting coffee and donuts at a vending machine.
You had the meeting out of your hand, kiddo.
They had their minds made up before I even went in there. They think I'm some kind of head case.
Cheerfully.
You are a head case. Have a donut.
Okay, so that was the script read. Now, let's talk context. Yeah, that's what we're going to talk about, because we have to think about a couple of things before we dive into this. Alien. Yes, the first one. Alien came out in 1979. In the 70s, the films that we were getting were generally quieter, more thoughtful. While obviously, you know, we had our Star Wars and our Jaws, the big blockbuster wasn't really the thing of the 70s. You know, there's Animal House. Yes, these were transition films. These were movies that were showing Hollywood what was coming next. In the 80s, everything became Star Wars. Everything became Jaws. Everything became Halloween in terms of those particular genres, right? Animal House, there were, you know, 14 Police Academy movies, all of which existed because Animal House existed. Hey, it's Animal House at a Police Academy. But a lot of the mainstream movies of the 70s were things like The Goodbye Girl, Robert Altman's The Wedding, Chinatown. And yeah, I know, there was a whole spate of disaster films, your Towering Infernos, and your Airports. Yeah. But by and large, 70s films are known for being thoughtful. And even our big sci-fi creepy alien movie was thoughtful. A horror film had quite the cast. John Hurt, Yaphet Kotto, Harry Dean Stanton, Tom Skerritt. These weren't teenagers running to the back of some house. We had real thoughtful casting and real thoughtful characters. By the time Aliens came around, it was the mid-80s, and it was time for Beverly Hills Cops, Blue Thunders, Back to Schools, Never Say Never Agains, a whole lot of Chevy Chase movies that nobody remembers. This was the 80s, so now we needed an alien movie to be an 80s movie. Big action, blow shit up movie. And we got it. Once again, we have Sigourney Weaver starring, just as she did in Alien. The rest of that cast, let's mention the rest of that cast real quickly. Michael Biehn, Paul Reiser, Lance Henriksen, Bill Paxton, and everybody's favorite Private Vasquez, Jeanette Goldstein. Now, Aliens is a perfect script in terms of scripting 101. It is a perfect script. Everything that's set up in Act 1 has a payoff. Everything that is introduced for a reason. Virtually every character has an arc. This is unusual today. This was not unusual in the 70s.
in the 80s, in much of the 90s. I don't know why this has become so rare. When I was learning script writing, these are basics. So when I say it's a perfect script, I don't mean it's a great script, as in, wow, what an amazing movie, although it is. What I mean is, Cameron absolutely knows how to write a movie. You introduce things organically. Characters have reasons for being there. They have motivations. They have personalities. They have ideas. They have bad ideas. But they all end up pushing the story or other characters into a particular direction. This is Screenwriting 101. Now let's talk about the script. This is an action movie. Alien, thoughtful horror, aliens, action movie.
All of our supporting characters, from Hudson to the sergeant, are basically cartoons.
We were just lucky Dolph Lundgren wasn't in it, all right? Although somewhere there's an Aliens point three where the aliens do have to fight the Russian boxer Drago in order to get to Earth. It exists. I know it's out there somewhere. Some parallel universe, someone's spec on their computer, on their Apple IIe. Floppy disk drive, it's out there. Someone's got this script somewhere. At any rate, the script seems to, from the start, be trying to capture a little bit of what we saw in Alien. The movie drops that pretense. What do I mean? Well, in the opening of the script, we have the description of space that's silent and endless. The Narcissus is floating out there, ill-fated lifeboat of the starfighter Nostromo. It's dark, it's dormant inside. It's like a crypt, it says. Figures enter, backlit and ominous. As light stabs in where the dust is wiped away, we illuminate a woman. Her face is peaceful. That's Ripley. It is all described in terms that you would describe a horror scene. Dark, crypt, light glares, torch bursts, figures enter ominously, backlit. This is all horror. Now, it's not going to stay a horror movie because this isn't a horror movie, but it's interesting that Cameron decided to start this way. My guess is that Cameron was trying to use the opening scenes to segue from the tone of Alien into the tone of Aliens, the action movie that he really wanted to make here. That's why we start that way. I'm guessing, I don't know, there have been a million books on behind the scenes, a couple documentaries, there's probably a commentary. I haven't seen all that. This is my guess. This is what it seems like to me that he's trying to do here on the page. I think on the screen that changed a little bit, but on the page, that seems to be what's happening here. To me, that's supported by what comes next, which is angry Ripley being a Karen. I want to see your supervisor. I've been waiting here too long. They got rid of that. I actually wonder if a lot of that was driven by Sigourney Weaver. I feel like she came in and said, you know what? I don't think Ripley should act like that. I don't think she should be flying off the handle that way. I'm guessing that Weaver kind of felt that Ripley should herself be a more thoughtful, intelligent character, you know, in order to leave the testosterone-fueled rage to characters like Vasquez. But you know what I'm getting at. One of the other things we get in the script is Ripley's daughter, who we learn died of cancer. And we get the sort of standard future comment of, oh, still haven't licked that one. This is something that I've seen in a lot of sci-fi and fantasy, where it is hard to come up with a good debilitating disease for the future. But again, this was in the script. This is to set up the arc of Ripley losing her daughter, only to then gain a new one in Newt, where she becomes a mother again, and a protective mother at that. You know, it's mother versus mother at the end of this. That was the big marketing push, if I recall. But of course, the whole backstory of her daughter was cut in favor of introducing the Marines sooner, because it's an action movie. That's what we're doing here. So now let's talk about what's on screen. A couple things happened to the beginning of this movie between the page and the screen. For example, there's no pinging of radar. What we get instead is the score brings us into the Nostromo. The other thing that I thought was really strange was we have on screen an immediate reveal of Ripley. In the script, this happens at a slower pace, at a more deliberate pace. We see the ship. We hear a pinging. We go inside. It's quiet. Something's making its way in. Then, boom, they're moving around. They're pushing their way through. They wipe a hand across. It's a slow, deliberate pacing. On screen, it's boom, boom, boom. Hey, look, it's Ripley. Hey, it's our star. It's our hero. She's going to go kick some ass later. But here she is right now, guys. Here she is right now. It takes all the mystery out of the opening. Maybe they were going to find an alien. Maybe they're going to find people that were killed by aliens. But I don't know. Seemed like a strange decision to show Ripley almost right off the bat like that. Plus, I feel like when you introduce your hero, you want it to have a little bit of gravitas. And so, taking that time, slowing it down the way Cameron had it in the script, to me is much stronger. I see why studio execs went, yeah, man, this is what we want. But I also feel like it was probably studio execs that said, oh no, show her right away. Show her right away. that's just a guess. Again, I don't know. But someone at some point said to him, well, you got to show her. You spend almost 2 minutes not showing her. You can't do that. We need to know that it's her on that ship. This isn't a horror movie. What do you think it is, 1979? There are a lot of little changes between what's on the page and what's on the screen. I mean, even Ripley looking at Jonesy and calling him Jonesy while saying he's Jonesy on the screen, he's Jones in the script, and she calls him an ugly little thing, which is just a regular cat. I don't know why they even had that line in here, but whatever. She's confrontational and angry in the script. In the film, she's fully in control of herself and trying earnestly to get the company men and women to listen to and understand her. I feel like that choice is better than what's on the page, but I feel like the more careful pacing of the script is stronger, whereas the movie is just, all right, guys, let's get into it. Boom, 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 boom. With Weaver having a slow boil over the course of the movie to the point where, you know, she's ready to take on the alien queen at the end, right? The other thing that happens in the movie versus the script is the dream sequence. On the page, there's so much going on. It's, you know, where's the supervisor or whatever she calls him? And she's impatient with the doctor, and there's a lot of chatter with Burke and the stuff with her daughter. All that's her dream, and it is a little much for a dream in a movie. A dream sequence shouldn't linger for quite so long, unless that's the point of your movie, is that you got a bunch of dream sequences and we never know what's real and what's not. You know, we've all seen those movies as well. But the dream sequence on screen gets to the point faster. We see how damaged and traumatized she is from her experience in the first movie. Just to get back to the daughter for a second, the daughter does come up later on in the movie. Ripley tells Newt that her daughter is gone. I always thought that that meant that she lost her before she went out into space. I thought that maybe she lost her in childbirth. I like that better than what Cameron was doing in this script. I don't think the fact that she lost all those years with her daughter really has any effect on her arc. If anything, I would think the story of Wounded Mother Ripley means there'd be some immediate transference happening. You know, where she's immediately protective of Newt like a mother. In the movie we got, it feels like Ripley's just doing her job and slowly bonding with Newt. As such, it makes sense to me that all that backstory is cut out. I'm so glad that they changed the line.
Do you people have earwax or what?
Yeah, it's not good. I don't know why that line exists on the page. Whew. Again, I feel like Sigourney Weaver had a lot to say about this scene and really worked with Cameron to get it into the place it needed to be. Looking at the rest of the script beyond the first 10 pages, it's pretty much exactly what was on the screen. One of the other big things that's cut from the film that is in the script is we get to meet Newt's entire family, and we get the colony. Much like the background on Ripley and her adult daughter dying, we don't need all of that. Just finding Newt and seeing that she's alone and seeing the photo of her before she looks the way she looks when we meet her, it really tells us everything we need to know. Although I have a feeling that that stuff was probably only cut for budgetary reasons. Okay, so what do we have here? We have a new take. I'm sure everybody that sent the studio a sequel for Alien was doing another horror movie. And James Cameron said, no, let's do an action film. It is no wonder that a studio saw this take and went, oh yeah, man, this is the one we got to do. It took some time. It wasn't that easy as I made it sound. I know that there was a lot of behind the scenes rigmarole, but you get my point. I think that's it. If there's something I've missed, if you want to discuss, if you want to let me know what you think, if you like Alien more than Aliens, like I do, if you like Aliens more than Alien, tell me. I'm on the socials. Okay, that's it for now. Thanks for coming. See you at the table read.
If you want to continue this conversation and follow me, I love talking movies, TV, and comic books at The Reality Comics on Blue Sky, which is like Twitter but not, and Instagram. That's both at The Reality Comics. Thank you so much for listening. The First 10 Pages is written, hosted, and edited by Keith Planet. Music by Edison Carter. Any corrections, questions, or comments, please reach out via social media on Blue Sky or Instagram at The Reality Comics. The First 10 Pages, copyright 2026.